Tax Update for Saturday, October the 14th, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, October the 14th, 2006. This week, let's try this again. Another AMT capital loss theory loses in the tax court. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and related document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CV presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. It's been kind of a slow week as tax news go, probably because we're approaching the absolute drop-dead filing deadline for extended individual returns. By the way, in case you've forgotten, that comes up on Monday, October the 16th. Hopefully you've gotten all your tax returns and all your clients' returns out the door and done. If not, well, hopefully you're doing it here quickly and getting things done before the final deadline comes upon us on Monday at midnight. But because of that, we had very little activity this week in actual tax news. So we're going to take a look, though, at a case that did come down and kind of takes another look at an issue we visited earlier in the Merlo case, where we deal with the issue of what happens with capital losses when you have an AMT capital loss adjustment and the question about the impact of that. Now, again, like the Merlo case, the case we're going to look at this week, Palahniuk versus Commissioner, is a published tax court decision. Meaning, again, that it apparently breaks new grounds, decides something new, and this decides a subtly different question than was decided in the Merlo case on the issue of AMT capital losses. Unfortunately for the taxpayer, it was again decided not in the taxpayer's favor, and it ends up illustrating for us the importance of proper planning when you're dealing with AMT exercises. Because the alternative minimum tax, when dealing with ISO exercises, I should say, when you're dealing with ISO exercises, the potential alternative minimum tax liability, especially should the value of the shares go down, can be a major problem. In essence, it's very easy to get in a position where the taxpayer ends up owing more in taxes than the shares are worth at the date the tax comes due on the net following April 15th. And it's important to understand that we don't really have our salvation in the capital loss rules or the difference in basis if the value drops substantially due to the problem of the $3,000 loss limitation provided by Section 1221 and the fact, or 1211, and that particular limitation does still apply for alternative minimum tax purposes as Merlo held and as we'll reinforce in Palahniuk versus Commissioner this week. Now, a lot of these cases are arising now because of the dot-com bubble, the dot-com bust that took place in the early part of this decade. Many of us had clients that were involved in various technology startup companies. At that date, everybody got paid in stock options, and many of those options were incentive stock options. Now, as we're aware, incentive stock options, for regular tax purposes, they are non-events when exercised. The option is exercised, and unlike non-qualified option, where the employee picks up the difference between the fair market value of the shares and the exercise price they pay on exercise as income, for incentive stock options, we don't pick up that differential. So if the stock option is one that meets the requirements for an incentive stock option, the employee does not pick up current income for regular tax purposes. However, this is one of those items that Congress decided had to be penalized under the alternative minimum tax provisions. In essence, this is one of those breaks that taxpayers were not supposed to get too much of a break for taking advantage of. So the issue becomes, for AMT purposes, that spread that would have been taxed if it was a non-qualified option will end up being taxed when computing the alternative minimum tax. We ignore the exclusion provisions found in the 400 series of the code for ISOs, and rather have to go ahead and pick up that spread in income and make an adjustment for AMT purposes. What that means is if you exercise highly appreciated stock, Quite often, the taxpayer ended up with an AMT liability. Now, as we're aware, the theory of the AMT as it's existed since the 86 Act is that we have timing differences and we have the minimum tax credit to hopefully help take care of those differences. That is, for those items that are expected to reverse, we get to compute a minimum tax credit in the year we pay the alternative minimum tax, and that credit goes forward to future years. In future years, we can use that credit to reduce our tax from the regular tax computed level down to the level computed under the alternative minimum tax. And we can continue to do that until we exhaust the credit carryover. Now, obviously, to make use of that credit carryover, it's important to have a spread between regular tax and alternative minimum tax. And the difference in basis in the stock is one of the ways we can get that spread. When we exercise incentive stock options and recognize the gain for AMT purposes, we get an alternative minimum tax basis for those shares that is substantially higher than the basis we have for regular tax. For regular tax, our basis is the exercise price, what we paid to exercise the option. For alternative minimum tax, our basis becomes the fair value of those shares on the date of exercise. When we later sell those shares for regular tax purposes, presuming we meet the 1 year and 2 year holding requirements, that is, we've sold the shares at least 2 years after the date the options were granted, and at least 1 year after the date we exercised the option, we get to treat that as long-term capital gains in the year of sale. We also compute the gain for AMT purposes, but for AMT purposes, we use the higher basis. That means when we go to compute the alternative minimum tax, in theory, we have a lower taxable income to work from, and that helps create the spread that enables us to use up, at least to a certain extent, the alternative minimum tax, the minimum tax credit. Now, that rarely works perfectly because our tax rates, unfortunately, our capital gains are lower than the tax rate that was imposed on the spread when we exercised the option under the AMT. But nevertheless, we certainly get to absorb a good chunk of it if under that scenario, and at least it helps us get somewhat the recovery of that extra tax that we prepaid. However, things get complicated when we have losses on the sale. Let's take a look at the facts in the Palahniuk case. In Palahniuk, we have a taxpayer who exercised ISOs issued by his employer in the year 2000. The exercise price was $99,949. At the time, the employer's stock was worth $2,185,958. Nice substantial gain, nearly $2.1 million difference between the value of what he now held and how much he had had to pay for it. Because they were ISO shares, that was a non-event for regular income tax purposes, but he had to recognize over $2 million of spread for alternative minimum tax and end up paying a minimum tax of over $580,000 that year. Now, this was kind of interesting because he generated a minimum tax credit carryover of $540,000 from that exercise. The remaining AMT was allocable to exclusion items, items that we do not get the deduction for. Now, as noted, if his shares had continued to appreciate, everything would be fine for Mr. Palahniuk because basically at that point he would get to take that differential when he then sold the shares after waiting the year-long period in order to sell and get capital gain treatment for regular tax purposes. But unfortunately for Mr. Palahniuk, what happened was the shares dropped in value. At the time he sold them the following year, the shares were worth $248,410. Still a nice chunk of change above the $99,949 he had paid for the shares, but significantly lower than the nearly $2.2 million that they had been worth on the date they'd been exercised, and certainly far less than the spread that he had picked up as income. So for AMT purposes, Mr. Palahniuk had a rather significant capital loss, in essence a capital loss of over $1,900,000. And for regular tax, he had a gain, in this case a gain of nearly $150,000 for regular tax purposes. So our issue became, well, what do we do about that differential? Now, Mr. Palahniuk had a couple of other facts that were important in this case. In addition, when he had that gain of basically $150,000 on his sale for regular tax purposes, he went ahead and sold other positions and other stocks that generated losses that fully offset that gain and, in fact, got him down to the $3,000 capital loss limitation that we find under Section 1211. So he had a small capital loss carryover for regular tax purposes. On his original return, he took the full difference in basis as a subtraction for alternative minimum tax purposes in computing the AMT, and therefore in both allowing him a minimum tax credit against that amount, so he could reduce his tax for that year to zero, because obviously with that huge loss, in essence, he wiped out all of his alternative minimum taxable income, so his AMT tax was zero, therefore allowing him to absorb the entire credit. Plus, he was able then, he claimed, a net operating loss carryback for AMT purposes into the prior year. And he based that on the theory that we found in Merlot that, in essence, he should be allowed to make that adjustment under the law, that there was nothing obvious to him that said Section 1211 would apply. Now, unfortunately, between the time he filed these returns and even after the time he filed his case in tax court, the Merlot case came down earlier this year. The Merlot case basically bounced out both of his theories about the proper treatment based on the initial return. And if you read the final footnote to this case, you'll note that Judge Laro indicates that, you know, the parties had pretty much agreed that, yeah, they understood that this case, the Merlot case, had been decided on these issues, and the issues had been decided against the taxpayer's position. So at this point, they had to come up with another theory. Well, Palahniuk's counsel decided maybe there was another way to try to save at least some of the tax benefits so that he didn't totally lose out and have to deal with the IRS position. Under the IRS position, since the same $3,000 limitation would apply for both AMT and regular tax, in essence, there'd be no adjustment for alternative minimum taxable income based upon the sale of securities. In both cases, there would be a $3,000 capital loss allowed for this year. Now, for AMT purposes, there'd be one humongous capital loss carryover, not the small little amount he had for regular tax purposes, but this huge number. And, of course, unless he generated offsetting capital gains in the future, that would continue to come into his income at $3,000 a year. Therefore, he became a member of the lifetime $3,000 a month, $3,000 a year AMT club, shall we say, for purposes of recovering his minimum tax credit. Obviously, that's going to cause the credit to be covered extremely slowly if that's your only differential on the tax return. That presented some real problems for Mr. Palahniuk because simply, especially these days with other alternative minimum tax issues that we find coming up, reality is a $3,000 spread may mean you'll never get to recover any of the credit because your other offsetting differences will always push you up into an AMT situation. So he decided maybe what they could do is say, no, we have a different theory. What we need to do is adjust the gain that was reported on this sale. So rather than worrying about, in his case, the $3,000 limitation directly, he said, well, we're not going to deal with that, but for regular tax purposes, we had recognized $151,461 difference between the $148,461 regular tax capital gain that we recognized in 2001 and the $3,000 allowable AMT loss. So under their theory, we should get an AMT subtraction of $151,461. Not nearly as nice as the subtraction we got earlier, but at least a much more significant number than the number we were having for quite a while, where we're looking at with $3,000 on both, we would end up with no adjustment. That's not, you know, they're sort of hoping that's not the case. And they may have based part of their idea here on the theory that was put forward in the Allen decision, which was a 2002 decision, where the tax court, and in fact Judge Laro in his opinion in that case, who was also the judge in this case, told us that the AMT was not truly a parallel system for taxes. Therefore, their theory was maybe this is an adjustment that we can take since the systems aren't parallel. Maybe this is an adjustment that would be allowable in computing it. Unfortunately, the court didn't buy the argument. In fact, Judge Laro specifically referred to the Allen decision in explaining why he rejected their theory. He noted that basically in Allen, he, meaning we, but actually he in this case for practical matter, the tax court, the we, but it was Judge Laro's written opinion, calculates AMTI by first computing regular taxable income and then making the necessary alterations to reflect the items described in Part 6. Thus, petitioners must calculate their 2001 AMTI by adjusting their 2001 taxable income to reflect the mandate of Section 56(b)(3), and their AMTI be computed with their AMT adjusted basis in the stock acquired through the exercise of the ISO rather than the regular tax basis. In other words, given they computed 2001 taxable income by factoring a $3,000 capital loss, their adjustment must reflect the substitution of the loss with the $3,000 allowable portion of their AMT loss. So we remove the $3,000 regular tax capital loss from the return, but then we just substitute right back in the AMT $3,000 loss. Now, he notes that they, of course, use this other calculation to bring it up. He claims we do not do that. In addition to the sales underlying the $148,461 capital gain, petitioners had other sales of capital assets during 2001. Although these other sales were unrelated to the ISO, they are nevertheless sales that must enter into the calculation of the 2001 regular tax capital loss, and hence must necessarily enter into the calculation of the petitioner's adjustment under Section 56(b). Considering all the sales together, the petitioner realized a regular tax capital loss of $5,164 and an AMT capital loss of $2,091,170. The non-recognition in both cases is limited to the $3,000. In essence, you can't ignore the fact that we had other sales, and you just kind of skip that and not worry about that when computing your capital gains or losses. You have to pay attention to those other sales that took place in that year when dealing with computing your $3,000 limitation. So while they tried a subtly different tactic than we had in the earlier case in Merlo, the result, unfortunately for the taxpayer, was still the same. The taxpayer exits the year, still has this huge AMT capital loss carryover, and has paid a large AMT tax of over $500,000 in the year 2000, and will only be able to recover that credit extraordinarily slowly over the future unless they have a large capital gain against which they can finally offset this humongous AMT capital loss carryover. Now, what does that tell us and what do we need to know? Well, there are a couple of issues and things to look at very similar to what we discussed in Merlo. Unfortunately, back in the days when the dot-com boom was going on, it was very difficult to convince clients that, in fact, the stocks may not stay up at that level forever, and there was some risk in exercising this ISO if the value of the stock declined. Most of your clients simply didn't want to hear that. Or even worse, you discovered they had exercised the ISO only after the following January 1st when they came in for their tax work and said, well, I exercised this and it was worth all this money, but that doesn't matter because it's worthless now. And you got to give the bad news that it does matter. The fact it's worthless now doesn't really matter. What matters is the fact that you exercised and had this huge spread. And had you come to me before year end, we might have been able to fix this problem. But now that it's after year end, we have a problem. How do you fix the problem? Well, if you have a taxpayer who's exercised ISO shares at a substantial spread and the value of those shares has declined substantially, there is an out under Section 422C, which provides in general that if you sell the shares and have a loss, the only amount you have to pick up as income under the disqualification is the difference between what you received for those shares and your original exercise price. You can ignore the loss unless you have engaged in a transaction that would disallow the loss, such as a wash sale. Now, as long as you do that within the same calendar year, we don't have a problem. If you switch calendar years, this doesn't work nearly as effectively because each calendar year stands alone, each tax year for the taxpayer. But a taxpayer who gets in before the end of December, executes the sale, sells off the proceeds, disqualifies the ISO, can save themselves a ton of money if they're faced with a case like we had here at Palahniuk. Now, in the Palahniuk case, it's not clear that, in fact, we knew there was a huge decline in value before December 31st. Sometimes taxpayers exercise these shares late in the year, so there's very little time frame during which you could sell the shares and trigger the loss. From a planning perspective, if a taxpayer will agree to it and if it makes sense, they need to understand the earlier in the year they exercise an ISO, the lower their risk, because we can bail them out if the share drops precipitously. The exposure period where we can't bail them out easily is going to occur from January 1st of the following year until the date we get to that one-year period. Once we're there, we can sell, trigger the capital gain, so there is some exposure. If a client is able to do so, I've always counseled that it's best to exercise those ISO options early in the calendar year, and then that gives you the out to be careful if the stock drops in price. I tell the client, make sure you contact me if there's been a substantial drop in price as we get close to December, at which time we may decide to sell off the shares and keep you from triggering being in a situation where you owe far more in alternative minimum tax than the shares are worth. While disqualifying will trigger ordinary income on the spread that still remains, quite often that can be substantially less than the alternative minimum tax to be realized if you continue to hold the shares. It's important to note these points simply because if you miss the fact that you can do this, it can be a very expensive miss for your client. As well, please realize that these days we see fewer of these issues. But it is instructive to note that it reminds us that everything that goes up in value can come down in value. And most recently, it seemed like a lot of people decided that real estate became the next big thing that couldn't go down in value after the stock market went down in value, so then they went on to real estate. It's important to remind all clients that everything can go down, and that there's exposures that you need to be aware of. Don't get yourself in a bad position. But ISOs are especially dangerous because you can get yourself in a very bad tax position simply by exercising the ISO and trying to play the tax game out to get the capital gain treatment at the back end. Now, as I said, it's been kind of a slow news week for taxes this week. In fact, there's very little that went on this week in the tax world. A couple of private letter rulings that were of some interest. A couple of notices. The IRS issued some regs that deal with deal with disregarded entities and the calculation of a flow-through basis from debt in a pass-through entity through an ignored entity LLC. So some little issues there that you could take a look at. But otherwise relatively quiet. Again, we're approaching the October 15th deadline. As well, Congress is out of town. Therefore, there's nothing coming from that direction. So hopefully things will be a little bit quiet here. Now, I'm working on getting ready to go out and do some more presentations on the road following this week. I will be leaving on the 23rd to head to Ohio to do a series of presentations. Generally, they're going to be current federal tax update presentations that'll be on the road in various places, doing three of them for the Ohio Society of CPAs. One of those will be in Cleveland, one will be in Mansfield, one in Zanesville. So if you're around any of those cities, I would appreciate seeing you come by, and we can take a look and discuss some of the developments over the years in taxes as we kind of take a broad view rather than the weekly view we take here on the tax update as to what's gone on. And then hopefully that'll allow me to still get podcasts up. I shouldn't have a problem with next week's podcast. It's the following week when I'm on the road and traveling from city to city and then flying back to Phoenix on Friday, when things might get interesting getting a podcast up in a timely fashion, but we'll hope that'll work fine without any problem. This has been the Tax Update Podcast for Saturday, October the 14th, 2006. The Tax Update Podcast is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Visit them in order to take a look at their email newsletters and their other information for tax professionals. Again, visit them on the web and consider subscribing at www.limeburgservices.com. This has been the Tax Update.